Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, tonight's episode includes a graphic description of violence against an animal. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm your host, Eric Peabody. And I must say, it's always a tough week following Halloween. The pumpkins are gone, the whole world feels a bit more wintry, and some depraved psychopaths have already put out Christmas decorations. I suppose we must soldier on, though, and luckily, we have a whole year of horror stories lined up for you. This week, we have three in the queue, a nice little charcuterie board of creepy delights that's so juicy and fresh that some of them are still crawling around. We'll be opening with My Brother Daniel by E. Reyes. This one should ease us right into Thanksgiving season with a heartwarming tale about a man reuniting with his brother. After that, we have two stories by Travis Brown. Only the Classics shows us that, even in a world with supernatural occurrences, sometimes the true evil is in the hearts of the living. And Something Walks Whistling, which demonstrates the importance of obeying your parents, even when the rules might not make sense. Also, Something Walks Whistling has recently been adapted for a Screambox anthology, so if you enjoy the story, be sure to go check that out as well. One last thing before we jump in here. Did you know that Chilling Tales has put out a book of our own scary stories? It's true. Head over to chillingbook.com to take a look and maybe just order a copy of your own. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author E. Reyes, I give you My Brother Daniel. 1. It was Thanksgiving morning. I drove into Devil's Hill, Arizona to visit my parents, and I was also going to see my strange brother Daniel. I was 25 years old back then, so Daniel was 35 years old at the time. In his mid-30s, he was a man who still lived at home with his folks and never left home or intended to. Daniel never had a girlfriend or boyfriend. Come to think of it, I never knew which sex he preferred or if he even wanted to be in any kind of relationship with another person. Our parents only had two kids, and I was the only one bringing in relationship-worthy females to meet them. But there was a string of ladies I kept away from Mom. But maybe it was Daniel's weight that kept him single. Daniel was about 400 pounds and at least 6 feet tall. All he wore were tight overalls that he had had since he was a teenager. He wasn't much to look at either. He was bald and looked like my mother's mom, my Grandma Jane, who wasn't much of a looker at all. The old lady used to give me the creeps. My mom had a disagreement with her a while back, so we didn't talk to her anymore. And for that, I'm glad. But I did get to see her in Daniel's face every time I saw him. Thank goodness he never smiled, because if that were to happen, I'd see nasty old Grandma Jane ready to smother me with one of her wet kisses and warm hugs. Minus the old lady Avon perfume she heavily coated on. It makes me shiver just thinking about it. I was driving to my parents' home alone that morning because my wife, Elsa, didn't want to be around my brother anymore. She told me that he had stared at her the whole time she sat across the table from him at the previous Thanksgiving dinner. Every bite of turkey he took, every mouthful of mashed potatoes he gobbled, he was staring at her. I guess I hadn't noticed because my dad was known to talk your ears off, and that was what he was doing to me. I believe he was talking about a mess his next-door neighbor got into while building a shed, and he was also making too much noise, and it was hard to get any sleep. But as Daniel sucked in a helping of canned cranberries and licked his fingers after greasing them with the butter dripping off his biscuit, he kept staring at Elsa. I asked her why she didn't look away from him or nudge me, tell me anything at all, and she said she felt scared and couldn't move. She told me she felt like a deer caught in the headlights of a big semi. And, of course, after my dad quit yapping my head off about his neighbor, I looked at Daniel, and he had his face aimed at his gigantic plate of Thanksgiving heaven. But I remember that Elsa gave me a weary smile, forced, and asked me how the macaroni salad she had made was. After all this, I would say that Daniel is indeed fond of the ladies, but I can't be too sure. Not even now. I guess Daniel had always been some sort of a creep. He was a sociopath. The guy had no feelings whatsoever, and his face never showed any sign of emotion. He could have sat down, watched a whole comedy film, and never laughed. You had a better chance of finding Bigfoot than finding a smile on Daniel's face. I also remember that he stayed in his room a lot. He would only come out to use the bathroom or get food or something to drink from the kitchen. I would never hear a good morning, hello, or good night from the guy. It's funny how things begin blooming in your mind once you start going down memory lane. All these small houses packed with forgotten memories start opening up to you, inviting you. One that opened up to me was remembering how Daniel murdered at least a dozen cats and dogs. He once had a pet turtle, but he killed it by cracking its shell with a rock down by the creek and severing its limbs. What's even more disturbing is that he murdered these innocent animals when he was a fully functioning adult in his mid-20s. I remember coming over to visit my parents one summer day when I saw him in the backyard axing a dog's body in half on the wood stump my dad used to cut wood on. After the top part of the dog's body fell off the wood stump, entrails right behind it, he continued to bash its brains in until the head was nothing but mush. I stood there until he was done. I just couldn't move. I probably didn't even blink. I was paralyzed with fear. When I could finally move, I returned to my car and drove home quietly. I told my parents about what had happened over the phone when I got home, but I never told Elsa. I didn't want to freak her out. My parents just shrugged it off and said that the dog bit Daniel or something that would never justify his actions to anyone but them. But maybe they were scared. If he had any mental complications, my parents chose to ignore them and sweep them away like dust under a rug. But the elephant was definitely in the room, and that elephant would make its presence known that Thanksgiving morning.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
2. I pulled up to the brown house at the end of Strawberry Avenue in the Grapevine neighborhood. The whole scenery looked like the epitome of autumn. As I stepped out of the car and felt the cold, crisp air, it was the definition of autumn. There were tons of yellow and brown leaves on the ground, the sky was cold and dark blue, and the world seemed filtered in fall. It was beautiful, but what awaited me inside the house was the total opposite. It was worse than coming home to find Daniel murdering a dog. As soon as I opened the front door of my parents' home, the rich smells of a Thanksgiving feast hit me. Turkey, gravy, stuffing, and pumpkin pie. These foods overpowered whatever else was ready to feast on, but I knew they were there for sure. What also hit me was the cold air inside the home. My parents were the type who cranked up the heater if it was 70 degrees. This was odd for them. I was expecting the sudden heat shock from stepping into an inferno, but all I received was a polar vortex. I still had my hand on the doorknob, and I stepped outside to check if my parents were home. Yep, their car was still parked in the carport as I'd thought, but I had to make sure. I stepped back in and closed the door behind me. I said, "Mom? Dad? I'm here." I heard no reply. "Hello?" But I still heard nothing. The kitchen light was on, and I noticed that it was the only light illuminated in the home. The curtains were still closed, and it looked like nobody had woken up that morning. When I stepped into the kitchen, I saw Daniel getting dinner ready.
"Hey, Brandon, have a seat, bro. Here,"
he said as he pulled out a chair for me. There was already a giant glass plate in front of it with the eating utensils on the side.
"Would you like some wine? Beer? Diet Coke or some Twist Mist Cranberry?"
I still remember how odd he looked. He was dressed in this same uniform of tight, dirty overalls, but the look on his face was different. It was disturbing. His eyes bulged out of his head, and he was sweating profusely. The smile on his face was genuine, but it felt menacing. But even more disturbing was that he was talking, saying something. Daniel rarely even told me hi, so hearing him talking and interacting with me was weird. I couldn't help myself, so I said, "Hey, what's gotten into you, buddy? Seem rather talkative today." Daniel opened the oven, bent down, and took out the turkey. He closed the oven door with his grimy boot and said,
"Well, I noticed how awful I was last Thanksgiving. All my life, to be honest. So I thought I'd make it different this year. I want to talk more. I don't want to hide anymore, you know?"
I remember I smiled after he said that. I thought that Daniel was going to start acting normal. I would have an average, functioning brother. But that was far from the truth. Now I know it. "Daniel, did you make the Thanksgiving dinner by yourself?"
"Yeah, I made the mashed potatoes from scratch. And no canned cranberries this year or store-bought pies. Everything is homemade, Brandon."
He sounded like a kid showing off a Lego Star Wars set he had completed.
"Sounds good to me," I said.
"So where are Mom and Dad? Pretty sure that this kitchen is the only room in this house that has any heat, and you know how annoying they get when it's cold. I'm glad it's chilly in here, though."
"I also made a fruit salad. It's extra good."
He had ignored my question. I took a sip of the soda he had served me and said, "Awesome. Daniel, where's Mom and Dad?" Daniel put the corn and green beans on the table and said,
Why don't you go get them? I'm sure they're upstairs. Oh, how I wish I never went up to go get them. 3. I got up from the table and started to the stairs. It was much colder in the other parts of the home. I walked up the creaky steps and called for them. Mom, where are you? Dad, are you up yet? But there was still no response. As I stood in front of their bedroom door, something told me not to open it. I felt the sudden need to run away and just get out. Daniel was acting weird, and my parents not being awake was strange. Plus, the heater wasn't on. I swallowed my fear and put my hand on the door. I called my parents one more time before going in, but I got no response. I opened the door slowly, and the smell of pennies drifted to my nose. 2 body shapes lay on the bed, covered by a white bedsheet that had blossoms of dark red where the heads were. I still remember the fright and anxiety that went all through my body. I didn't know if I wanted to cry, scream, or run. The only thing I did was start walking to the bed. I had to lift off the sheet. I had to see if they were okay or dead. I didn't dare see my parents dead, possibly murdered, but I had to be sure with my own eyes. I lifted the bed sheet, and the image is one I could not and will not ever get out of my mind. My parents had black, empty holes where their eyes should have been. Dried blood ran down from the sockets, creating dark red lines down their cheeks. Their mouths were also covered with blood. I didn't want to know why. I covered their faces again with the sheet and vomited all over the floor. Loads of puke splashed into my dad's slippers. I felt terrible for doing that. After getting rid of that morning's breakfast, I went to the door and called for Daniel. Daniel, it's Mom and Dad. They're dead. My shout was followed by a minute of silence. Finally, Daniel replied, I know. Come down here. You know? Daniel, did you kill them? At that moment, I realized Daniel had upgraded from dogs and cats to Mom and Dad. I knew this day would come. I saw it coming the very day I saw him with the axe. You're going to jail, Daniel! I can't believe what you've done! I shouted as I made my way downstairs. I felt sick. I remember holding onto the walls as I made my way down. I was lightheaded, but also pumped with adrenaline. I was struck with grief and anger. I was mad at him for committing such an evil act and for making me have to see it. Before I made my way into the kitchen, I was caught with a sudden shock of fear and realization. What if he was going to kill me next? I had no weapons, nothing. I grabbed the fireplace poker before going in, noticing it was caked with blood at the tip. My parents' blood. It had to be. Brandon, just come in here and enjoy dinner. He wanted me to eat after I had seen such a horrible thing. Daniel had snapped. I raised the fire poker in a baseball batting stance and walked into the kitchen. My brother was sitting at the head of the table with a mountain of food on his plate. He looked like he always did. Quiet, ugly, fat, and unfriendly. The chatty, smiling person I had seen when I had first walked in was gone. Sit down, eat, Daniel said. His eyes were locked on mine. I felt intimidated. Daniel, you just killed our parents. Are you serious? Weren't you tired of how they always looked at us? Tired of how it was always their way or the highway? Judging how we live, how we work, what we believe in? I looked at him dumbfounded and said, Daniel, actually, they never gave you anything like that. I was the one who always had to deal with all of that. Those are the cons that I dealt with all of my life. Just sit down and eat. I'm calling the cops, I told him, but before I went to grab my phone, I noticed something horrific stuffed inside the turkey. 4. I couldn't believe what was lying inside the bird. Four eyeballs and two tongues served as the toppings on the brown stuffing that Daniel had cooked. Now I knew why my parents were eyeless and had bleeding mouths. I had dropped the poker to the floor and pulled up a seat from the table to sit down before I collapsed from weakness. I took another look inside the turkey and then looked away. "Daniel," I said, "what in the hell did you do?" He took a spoonful of mashed potatoes with a heavy coating of gravy and stuffed it in his mouth. I'd always hated the way he held his spoon in a fist. Daniel giggled. "You know, I don't know why I put their eyes and tongues inside the turkey. Maybe I did it because they were always watching and talking down at us. I thought it was a great gag, though. Reminds me of something a B-horror movie would feature, you know? Something like, feast your eyes on this, or jaw-dropping. I don't know, something like that." He laughed like a hyena. I held my head in both hands and said, "This isn't a movie. This isn't normal." "Quiet down, Brandon," he said to me with an annoyed look. "Elsa will be here any moment now." At that point, I had thought, oh no, was he planning to murder Elsa and me? Were we going to become a gag for his B-rated horror scene? I looked at him in disbelief and said, "What?" Daniel paid no mind to me. He started eating fruit salad, getting it all over his face. He put down his spoon and finally spoke up. "I thought you would be happy, Brandon. They always gave you crap. Last year, after dinner, you all argued, remember? They were getting on your case and telling you that Elsa never lets you do anything, saying how she's the man in the relationship and she doesn't let you visit anymore. I swear Dad said she has your balls in her purse." I remembered that argument like it happened yesterday. My parents weren't fond of Elsa. Why? I believe it was because she didn't censor herself. For instance, if my mother had something mean or rude to say, Elsa didn't hold back. I liked that about her. "Daniel, I understand that you've always tried to look out for me, even if you never talked as much as you have today, but you killed our parents. That's a lifetime in prison, in this case, the crazy house. Do you realize, truly realize what you've done?" Daniel stopped eating and threw his spoon to the table. It bounced up in the air and landed by the turkey. I took a look at where it had landed and felt sick. One of the eyeballs was looking at me with an eternal stare. Was it my mom's or my dad's? I didn't know and didn't care to ever find out. It's painful to remember such horror, but my therapist, Dr. Crane, tells me it's best to let everything out, even if the scabs I'm picking at begin to hurt and bleed again. After tossing the spoon, Daniel looked at me with crazy, angry eyes and said, "You've always been unappreciative, Brandon. You never thanked me for anything. That dog bit you, and I killed it. I killed it. You were too chicken shit to do anything about it. Years later, and you're too chicken shit to face Mom and Dad and stand up to them, so I had to take care of it for you." The dog never bit me. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Daniel was going crazy. "Daniel, calm down, okay? You need help. You need help more than ever, and I will ensure you get the best help you can get, okay?" Suddenly, I heard a car pull up at the carport. It was Elsa. My heart started to race even more. I looked out the window from the kitchen and saw her getting out of the car. Daniel also looked out the window, and he got up from his chair. I picked up the poker from the floor and also stood up. "Don't you dare touch her! Don't you dare, Daniel!" He never stopped walking and never gave me a look. He said, "I'll be right back. I'm not going to hurt Elsa, and you shouldn't either." "Why would I hurt her?" I asked him, confused. I didn't know why he had said that, and I still don't know why. Daniel went out the back door into the backyard. Was he getting a chainsaw? I didn't know. All I was thinking was that I had to leave fast and take Elsa with me. Before I could get to her, Elsa walked in and said, "Brandon, what's going on?" She looked beautiful, even with concern on her face. Her blonde hair lay flat on her shoulders, and she wore a brown jacket. Her blue eyes were tense, and she looked serious, wanting answers. Before I could answer her, she said, "I know you called me about 2 hours ago. I barely saw the missed call until half an hour ago. I'm sorry, love. So, what happened?" "Elsa, I never called you," I told her. She looked at me with a frown. She opened her mouth and said, "Yes, you did. You..." The poker was still clutched in my hand. She took a look at it and said, "Why are you holding that?" "It's Daniel. He killed our parents." Elsa gasped and took a step back. I started to walk toward her, but then she said, "Stay away from me, Brandon. You stay the hell away from me. Get back." I stopped walking toward her and felt incredibly strange. Then a jolt of fear rushed through me because I realized she thought I had murdered them. I walked back to the table and placed the poker by the turkey. As soon as I did that, I heard her scream a high shrill of terror. She had seen the eyeballs in the turkey. "What is wrong with you?" "I didn't do this, Elsa. Why do you think I did this?" "I should have known," she said as she walked back to the door. "I should have known." "Should have known what?" I called after her. She opened the door and went running to the car. She had slammed the front door in my face. After struggling to open the warped old wooden door, she was already in her car and driving away. The tires screeched as she rode out of the neighborhood. I didn't know what to do. I ran to the backyard and looked around, but Daniel wasn't anywhere to be found. I was glad. Suddenly, my phone started ringing. It was Elsa. "Elsa, why do you think it was me? How could I do something like that? It was Daniel who did it." "Brandon," she started. It sounded like she was crying and going hysterical. "Listen to me. Daniel is dead. He's been dead since before you killed all those animals." "Elsa, I never killed any animals. It was Daniel who killed them." She ignored my protests and said, "No, it was you. You have these small phases in which you think your brother Daniel's still around. When you're scared of facing situations that you don't know how to handle, you tend to do that. You're so messed up now that you don't even know what's real or not." It was much colder outside, so I went back in to sit down. I couldn't believe what Elsa was telling me. Why was she saying this to me? I cleared my throat and said, "Elsa, I don't know what you're trying to do or who put you up to this, but you have no idea what you're talking about." I had to laugh at the whole situation. "Brandon, I can't do this anymore. I love you. I love you so much, but I can't anymore. You're dangerous. The cops will be there any time now. Goodbye." Before I could say anything to her, the door busted open, and two cops came in and arrested me. 5. Long story short, I'm here at Woodland Asylum now, on the east side of Devil's Hill. I never saw Elsa again, and I miss her so much. I tried writing to her and calling her, but she never returned my letters or answered my calls. Dr. Crane, you're the one reading this. Yeah, you. Told me to write everything down, and that's what I'm doing. That's how I remember it, and that's the truth. Dr. Crane says Daniel's dead. He even brought in a death certificate and a picture of his gravestone to prove it. But I think this is all some giant conspiracy shit against me. It was all a setup. Elsa probably ran off with my boss and had me committed. My parents were dead, and I was the perfect person to blame since I was there. Dr. Crane told me that Elsa said I went early to my parents' home around 5 in the morning because I would cook Thanksgiving dinner. He told me why Elsa spent Thanksgiving with her parents. She said it was because I had been giving her strange looks at the dinner table the previous year, and my parents and I had an argument. The argument had happened, but I never looked at her that way. Daniel did. but I can't blame Elsa. This is all Daniel's fault. The doctor says that I use Daniel as an alter ego or personality, but he's full of shit. Sorry, Doc, you told me to write it all down. He tried telling me that I had resentment towards my parents for ignoring me when Daniel died, but Daniel never died. I saw him kill that dog. I saw him. My parents are dead. I lost my wife. And now I'm sitting here with the freaks and crazies as if I belong here. I don't. I just want to go back home. I am looking forward to one thing, though. Daniel's coming to visit me tomorrow for Thanksgiving. Dr. Crane will finally get to meet him in the flesh.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You've been listening to My Brother Daniel by E. Reyes. E. Reyes is a writer, a horror fanatic, and the author of the novel The House on Moon Creek Avenue. Overloading on books and movies and working retail, Reyes brings terror and the unimaginable to everyday life with his experiences and transcends them into a different range of characters and situations. When not watching scary movies and reading books, E. Reyes is busy being a father and a husband and putting in time playing Xbox. He resides in Arizona. Hey, listeners, stepping aside real quick to ask, are you listening to this on YouTube right now? If you are, it really helps us out if you would drop a like and maybe even leave a comment. Thank you for helping us feed the machine. Now, back to the story. Next, from author Travis Brown, I present Only the Classics. When we were growing up, Sean was closer to a brother than a friend. He must have spent more time at my house than his own. My parents knew Sean's home life wasn't exactly... it wasn't in any danger of being adapted into a Hallmark movie, that's for sure. So they let him spend the night anytime he needed to, or come over for dinner whenever he wanted, even spend the weekend. But my parents didn't realize just how terrible Sean's home was, not until it was too late to help him. They didn't know how ugly his world was because I never told them, and I'll carry the weight of that omission with me for the rest of my life. Sean's family moved in down the street from mine when he and I were both 10 years old. By 11, we were so close you could hit one of us and the other would feel it. Lord knows it seemed like I could feel it whenever Sean would turn up to school with fresh bruises on his arms, his legs, his ribs. You see, Sean's dad had the low cunning of all cruel things. He knew how to hide, how to blend, to deflect. I was the only one Sean told how bad it was, but he made me promise to never tell. I think he was worried that if people knew, someone would come take him away, leaving his mom living with a monster and no one to protect her. I know now that I should have said something, should have told someone, but we were 11 and I loved him like a brother, and a promise back then felt so heavy and solemn. Sean spent his 12th birthday at my house. By then, my parents knew his family wasn't going to celebrate anything, so my mom made a cake and my dad picked up pizza, and the four of us had one of the best days I can remember. You see, Sean and I had an unusual obsession. Old monster movies, especially the black and white Hammer horror pictures. We watched them on repeat any chance we got, and we spent that whole afternoon into the evening marathoning Wolfman and Frankenstein and the rest. Even though we'd seen those old black and white movies a million times, Sean never got tired of them or wanted to watch any of the new stuff. "Only the classics, Joey," he told me. "People remember the classics. They're unforgettable, you know? They never fade away." I'll never forget that last birthday of his. I hope it was a bright point for Sean,
Even as a kid, he had the oldest eyes, soft blue and cracked with worry. 2 weeks after he turned 12, Sean and his mom were both dead. The police caught up with his dad at a gas station in Easton. He confessed, but never gave a reason for why he did what he did, why he decided to take my friend away. I think people like him don't need much of a reason. Some people just like hurting people. We all took Sean's death hard, but I was physically sick for weeks after. Part of it was grief, but there was also guilt. If I'd spoken up, I'd be sitting on the couch with Sean watching Van Helsing stake Dracula, instead of watching them lower my friend into the ground on a bitter, bright winter day. A promise is a sacred thing, but silence in the face of malice only profits the monsters. Sean's death drained a lot of the color out of the world for me. I let fear in. Not just let it in, but built it a home. My mind was clouded with nerves like tripwires. I stopped trusting, and I began cultivating the worry in my soul like some grim garden. For a long time, years, I struggled to see any good in the world, any light. Then I met Andy, ginger, freckled, always grinning Andy. It's cliche to say that falling in love can change your life and alter the way you see the world, but every cliche is grown from a root of truth, and Andy gave me a gift. She restored some faith in me, made me wonder if maybe, just maybe, people are inherently good and that the world can be a fine place, like Hemingway said, or at least worth fighting for. Andy was the best thing that ever happened to me. Then our daughter Emily was born, and I found myself waking up with a stupid smile nearly every morning, not sure how one man could be so lucky. But always, in the back of my mind, there was the shadow of Sean. It weighed heavy, the absolute certainty that monsters existed, and that innocence wasn't a shield, but a beacon. Still, for a long time, we were happy. The world was quiet. It made sense. I began to relax. Then, one cloudy, cold December afternoon, I heard my wife scream, and I instantly knew the world had come to collect on all the happiness I'd borrowed.
Joe!
Andy had never screamed like that, not when she broke her leg or when she found a snake in the garage. I knew, with a father's certainty, that something had happened to Emily. I tore through the house, from my office to the kitchen, in seconds. Andy was at the window. She turned when I thudded into the room.
"He took her," she told me,
voice like the last breath of a drowning man.
"A man just grabbed her. She was right there in the yard."
I looked out the window and saw a dark red sedan already at the corner of our street. It screeched into a turn. Someone had snatched our daughter out of her own yard, 30 feet from her house, and I was watching them take her away. She'd been building a snowman. Cold spread in me, dread sinking like a rock into the well of my stomach. The evil that I knew was in the world brushed past me again, snatched up my life, and sped away in a beat-up piece of shit Ford. Ugly, random malice. No, I thought. Anything but Emily. Call the police, I told Andy. I was already moving. The brake lights from the Ford were still fading as I moved to the door. For one sharp, panicked second, I couldn't find my keys in the bowl on the table. Then my hand closed on them, and I was outside, and I was driving. This isn't happening, I thought. You hear about terrible things on the news, random shootings, tragic accidents, kids taken in parking lots while their parents are loading groceries. It happens. You know that with a certainty. But with equal certainty, you refuse to believe it can happen to you. There I was, racing down my quiet street, desperately searching for the red glow of brake lights in front of me. I'd seen the Ford take the first right as they sped away from my house. I whipped my car into the turn, skidding on the icy road.
It had snowed earlier in the week, and the steel wool-colored clouds promised even more snow. I prayed the weather would stay clear just a little longer. After I made the turn, I felt a fresh wave of panic rise in my stomach. There was no sign of the red Ford. There was only the empty street that branched off into three different turns. It began to snow, gently. I made a sound somewhere between a snarl and a whimper. I bashed my fist into my steering wheel once, twice, but I kept driving. Even if I didn't know where to go, I couldn't stop. At least I had a chance of picking the right turn. If I stopped, if I froze, the Ford would be gone. Emily would be gone. Unwelcome flashes of what could happen to my daughter if I couldn't catch them danced across my mind. She was six. What if 6 years was all that she got, all that I got with her? I was crying, ugly, rasping sobs, but I was still driving. Please, I prayed. Please, God, please, anyone that's listening, don't let her go. Please, help. I don't know where to go. Please. I was coming up on the first turn, a left. I hesitated. No. It was a thought so subtle it was barely an inclination, most likely my imagination. But I had no other guidance or ideas, so I clutched onto that gossamer thought like a falling man grabbing at a thread. Here. I was at the second turn. I took it without hesitation. The snow was falling harder, but I began to speed up. I took the turn. I was committed to the path. All I could do was drive fast and trust I was headed in the right direction. I didn't slow down for turns. My weird internal GPS would give me a nudge before a necessary turn approached. I'm not sure how long I drove. There were a few close calls with slipping when I took turns too quickly. But luckily, my tires were good, my brakes were better, and the weather was keeping most sane drivers off the road. Here. Another nudge. Here. 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 It was possible I was losing my mind, that Emily being taken had caused a breakdown and I was chasing my own hallucinations. But I had no better options than to chase phantoms. And at least my hallucinations had a certain conviction with each little push. I came very close to wiping out in a ditch while banking through a sharp left turn. As soon as I wrestled control back from the road, I looked ahead, and I cheered. Not more than 200 yards in front of me, the red Ford was cruising along. He must not have realized he was being followed or thought he'd lost me. I guessed he was doing almost exactly the speed limit, maybe even a mile or two under out of deference to the ice, and to avoid attention. It would have really ruined his day to make a clean escape just to get pulled over for speeding. So he drove on, unremarkable, like he didn't have a care in the world. I pushed my accelerator all the way down. He was about to have a lot to care about, real fucking quick. I was nearly on the Ford's bumper before he noticed something was up. The car sped up. I followed easily, about one car length behind. The Ford was old and wasn't in great shape. I doubted he could lose me now. However, there wasn't much I could do besides follow. I'd left the house in such a rush that I had completely forgotten my phone. It was becoming difficult to see ahead through the snow, but I was close enough that I could memorize the Ford's license plate, if nothing else. We were driving fast, and he was starting to drift across the center line. Sooner or later, I knew we would draw attention, hopefully police attention, and the mad chase would be all over. All I had to do was stick with him, to stay near Emily. I barely had time to register that he'd slammed his brakes before our cars collided. At the last second, I tried to swerve around the Ford, but couldn't clear him, and clipped the left of his bumper hard. We both spun out in opposite directions and went off the road, him to the right, me crossing lanes and going off the left embankment. I'm not sure what he was thinking, hitting the brakes, whether he was trying to make me back off or to scare me, or if he saw something in the road, I don't know. My last conscious thought was a prayer that Emily was wearing a seatbelt. Then, my car crashed into a tree, and my vision went black. Get up. That nudge again, stronger now. A white light, small as a pinprick, but expanding, cut through the blackness. No time. I came to, vision blurry and the taste of copper in my mouth. My car had impacted a large evergreen. My head must have hit the window. The airbag was pressing me back into my seat. I suddenly felt claustrophobic and scrambled to get out of the car. Calm down. It was more than a nudge now. It was a voice. I listened. I breathed. I undid my seatbelt and stumbled out of the door. The cold hit me almost as hard as the accident. An icy wind ripped through the trees around the road, shaking the branches and whipping the snow. Even though it was early afternoon at the latest, the clouds had grown swollen and dark as fresh bruises. Visibility was shit. To top it off, I hadn't taken a jacket with me, and the cold clawing through my shirt had set my body shivering. Keep moving. I had no phone, no coat, but I listened. I kept moving. The Ford wasn't far away, across the road, maybe 100 feet ahead of where I'd stopped. It was also pressed into a tree. I let out a little sigh of relief when I made my way over and saw that the impact was on the driver's side. Both of the Ford's doors were open. The car was empty. I looked for tracks, but the wind and still falling snow obscured the ground. The panic began rising again. I swallowed to keep it down. Shivering, arms wrapped around my chest, I searched for any sign of where they'd gone. To my right, ahead in the forest, I saw a light flash for a moment. It was bright white against the shadows in the woods, yet grainy, like it was coming through a filter. With no better options, I set off, trudging through the snow towards the light. Whenever I came close to where I'd seen a flash, a new light would flicker nearby. I kept following, and as I went, I felt the cold peeling away. There was a new energy in me, a resolve. The farther I went into the woods, the stronger I felt. I was committed to the path. Not far from the second or third light, I spotted blood on the snow. In the fading winter light, the blood looked smudged, dark red like the Ford. I let out a ragged breath and hoped the blood wasn't from Emily. There was more blood up ahead, trailing towards a tight copse of trees. The light flashed again from the other side of the trees. I headed that direction as fast as I could trudge through the calf-high snow. I made it through the trees, and there was Emily. A tall man I'd never seen before was dragging her by the arm. He was limping and had a red stain all down his tan jacket. Emily looked shaken, but not hurt. For the first time since she'd been taken, I felt a swell of relief. She was maybe 20 feet away, a small shape in a purple jacket against a field of white. Then, the man looked back over his shoulder and saw me. He jerked Emily's arm hard, trying to get her to speed up. The relief I felt was immediately doused and replaced by anger. Anger was not really a fair word for the emotion I felt. This stranger had stolen my child, could have killed her in a car crash, and now he was hurting her, trying to drag her away. Anger wasn't the right word at all. Rage didn't do it either. I considered myself a more or less normal guy. I hadn't even been in a fight since the seventh grade. But when Emily turned back, tried to run to me, screamed, "Daddy!" I felt something uncoil deep in my chest, and then I was yelling and running, and I was fast. The stranger looked back again, stumbled, and fell in the snow. Emily slipped away. The man tried to scramble back up, but I was on him. I think there's an animal, an ancient thing that lays its lair in the heart of every parent. No matter how soundly that inner animal sleeps, seeing your child threatened has a way of pulling that creature out, and it comes out ugly. "Please," the man said as I hit him again
and again and again.
Please stop, please.
It was like painting a portrait, but in reverse. Every time I hit him, his features lost a little detail, began to blur and smudge. I think I was still yelling. A small, rational part of my brain took an inventory and noted that both of my hands ached, that my shoulder hurt from the crash, that I was shaking from rage and the cold. But the whispers from that rational piece of my mind were drowned out by the roaring hate punctuated with every impact of knuckles into a rapidly softening face. The stranger looked much younger than I would have pictured. Pale, early 20s, with a pretty sorry excuse for a beard.
Please?
He struggled to slip the word out through shattered teeth and swollen lips.
Stop!
My mind was an empty theater, playing a slideshow of every bad thing that could have happened if he'd gotten away with my daughter, every way he could have hurt her. A nerve-ripping shot of pain finally pierced the black fog of rage. My left hand was broken. I let it dangle at my side and kept swinging with my right. I stopped screaming long enough to spit out a few words.
My daughter! You fuck my daughter! My...
Another wet, red impact.
Daughter!
That black fog kept getting heavier and heavier, choking out the rest of the world. There was no room for anything but the need to hurt this man. Then, slowly, light began to fill my vision. I felt a hand on my shoulder. I turned, suddenly, painfully aware that my daughter needed me. But instead of Emily, the hand on my shoulder belonged to a flickering ghost. Sean, I said. It was a statement, not a question. Even though he seemed washed out, drained, and filtered, it was so clearly my friend, just as I'd last seen him. He looked young. The light around him blinked and faded. Looking at him was like watching an old movie, something black and white. Hi. I heard his voice in my head, the same voice that had guided my turns. It was louder now, distinctly familiar. Hi. Sean smiled and nodded to his right. Emily was wrapped up in a fetal position, head covered by her arms, trembling. As quickly as it had hit, the anger drained from me, replaced with a bone-deep shame. She was trying to block out the sounds and sight of her dad killing a man in front of her. I rolled away from the stranger, stumbled, made my way to Emily, and hugged her close.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry,
I whispered, my forehead against her brow.
I'm sorry. It's okay. You're okay now. Emily, you're okay. I love you.
I choked on the last words, exhausted, sick from the adrenaline dump, the enormity of what I'd nearly lost crashing over me. The injuries and the cold caught up to me then. I was only just able to turn away before I threw up all over the fresh snow. I felt a small hand on my arm, and then Emily was hugging me tightly.
You found me,
she whispered into my shoulder. I cried. I forgot my injuries, the cold, my anger. I forgot my fear and everything else that wasn't her face. I held her and I cried, huge, racking, beautiful sobs. I had been given my world back, and I cradled it, cradled Emily, close. I'm not sure how long we stayed that way, father and daughter holding each other in the snow. Eventually, I looked up and found Sean watching us, a sad smile on his face.
Thank you, I told him.
He nodded. Then his smile slipped away, and he looked down at the stranger. The man was still breathing, but his face looked like a smashed pumpkin. The snow around the stranger was stained scarlet, a short red road showing where he'd moved. He'd been trying to drag himself away from me, still on his back. I think he'd made it about 4 feet.
She shouldn't watch, Sean said.
I nodded, hugging Emily and turning so her back was to the stranger.
You shouldn't watch, Sean said.
I shouldn't, but I had to.
After a moment, Sean, flickering in black and white, turned to the stranger. Where my anger had been a rabid thing, Sean's was still and cold as a dead star. He stood over the stranger, who started to raise one hand weakly. As I watched, Sean put a hand over the man's mouth. The stranger gurgled, trying to scream, but Sean seemed to be melting, pouring himself over the man like liquid lead. Sean dissolved, his grainy light spilling over and into the stranger. The man was thrashing and making choking sounds. Whatever Sean was doing, it must have hurt. The light became too bright, and I had to jam my eyes shut. When I opened them, Sean and the stranger were both gone, leaving nothing but red stains on the snow. There was one last flicker of black and white, a fading echo of my friend.
"Wait!" I yelled. "Don't go!"
There was no reply, but something did linger. Some of the pain in my hand and shoulder eased. The sharp edge of the cold lessened. I knew that Sean wasn't completely gone.
"Thank you," I said to the empty snow. "I'm so sorry I didn't help you. I'm so sorry I couldn't..."
The phantom of a reassuring touch. I knew he forgave me, knew he never blamed me at all, even though I didn't think I'd ever forgive myself.
"Who was that?" Emily asked me. "Who was the boy in black and white?"
"That was your Uncle Sean," I told her. The snow still fell, the wind still shook the trees, and the sun was draining into the horizon. But I felt warm there in the woods, safe and looked after.
"Let me tell you about your uncle."
A state trooper found Emily and me sitting there not long after sundown. Someone had reported the crashed cars, and the trooper had followed our tracks. There were a few places where the snow had covered the footprints, he told us, but he'd seen a flash of light and found us there. I did my best to explain what had happened. I must have sounded like I was in shock. The trooper gave me his jacket and radioed for help. The woods became a swarm of police and activity. There was even a helicopter. But they never found the stranger. The official story was that I'd fought the guy off and he'd run. My wife was afraid that he'd come back, but she believed me when I told her we would never, ever need to worry about that man again. She didn't ask any questions, but there was a savage love in her eyes when she looked at me. I knew Andy had her own sleeping animal, coiled and waiting if anyone ever came for Emily again. The world can be a dark and awful place. There are monsters everywhere, and the worst of them are often the best at blending in. Whenever the news is too bleak or my fear starts to get the best of me, I gather my family together and we watch old movies. Only the classics, like I used to watch with Sean. I sit with Andy and Emily, and sometimes I talk about him, and it's almost like he's there with us. Because Sean's a classic, and the classics are unforgettable. You've just heard Only the Classics by Travis Brown. And finally, also from Travis Brown, here's Something Walks Whistling. Every night, no matter the weather, something walks down our street, whistling softly. You can only hear it if you're in the living room or the kitchen when it walks by, and it always starts at exactly 3:03. The sound starts faint, somewhere around the beginning of the lane near the Carson place. We're towards the middle of the street, so the whistling moves past us before fading away in the direction of the cul-de-sac. When I was younger, my sister and I would sneak into the kitchen some nights to listen. Mom and Dad didn't like that, and we'd catch hell if they found us out there, but they were never too hard on us since we always stuck to the one big rule. Don't try to look at whatever was whistling. My neighborhood's a funny place. I've lived here since I was 6, and I love it. The houses are small but well-kept, good-sized yards, plenty of places to roam. There are a lot of other kids here my age. I turned 13 back in October.
We grew up together and would always play Foursquare in the cul-de-sac or roam around from back porch to back porch in the summer. This was a good place to grow up. I'm old enough to see that. And there's only the two strange things here. The night whistling and the good luck. The whistling never bothered me much. Like I said, I couldn't even hear it from my bedroom. But Mom and Dad don't like talking about it, so I've stopped asking questions. My dad's a strong guy, tall and calm. He has an accent since he moved to the U.S. as a kid. His family, my grandparents, they're from the islands. That's what they call it. My dad, the only time he isn't so calm is if the whistler comes up. He talks a little quicker then, his eyes move faster, and he tells us not to think about it so much and to always remember the one rule, the big rule. Don't try to look outside when the whistler goes past. Not that we could look, even if we wanted. See, there are shutters on the inside of every window, thick pieces of heavy canvas that pull down from the top and latch to the bottom of the window frame. Each latch even has a small lock, about the size of what you'd find on a diary. My dad locks those shutters every night before we all go to bed and keeps the key in his room. My mom, I don't know what she thinks about the whistling. I've seen her out in the living room before at 3:03 when the sound starts. I could see her if I cracked my door open just an inch to peek. She's not out there often, at least I haven't caught her much, but once or twice a month, I think she sits out there on her big red couch just listening. The whistler has the same tune every night. It's cheerful. Remember how I said that there are two odd things about where I live? Well, besides our night whistler, everyone in my neighborhood is really lucky. It's hard to explain, and Dad doesn't like us talking about this part much either. But good things just seem to happen to people around here a lot. Usually it's small things, winning a radio contest or getting an unexpected promotion at work or finding some arrowheads buried in the yard. You know, the authentic kind. The weather is pretty good and there's no crime and everybody's gardens bloom extra bright in the fall. A million little blessings, I've heard my mom say about living here. But the main reason we stay here, why we moved here in the first place, is my sister Nola. She was born very sick, something with her lungs. We couldn't even bring her home when she was born, only visit her in the hospital. She was so small, I remember. Small even compared to the other babies. A machine had to breathe for her. We moved into our house here to be closer to the hospital. As soon as we moved here, Nola started getting better. The doctors couldn't figure it out. They chalked it up to whatever they were doing. But we all could tell they were confused. But my parents knew. Even I knew. Nola getting better was just another of the million little blessings we got for living in our neighborhood. So that's why we stayed, even after we found out that for every small miracle that happens here every day, now and then, some bad things happen. But they only happen if you look for the whistler. See, our neighborhood has a welcoming committee. They show up with macaroni casserole and a gift basket and a manila folder whenever someone new moves in. They're very friendly. Four people showed up when we moved in 7 years ago. The committee made small talk, gave me a Snickers bar, and took turns holding Nola. It was her first week out of the hospital, so they were extra careful. Then, the committee asked to speak to my parents in private, so I was sent to my room, where I still managed to hear nearly every word. The welcoming committee told my parents about how nice the neighborhood was. Really exceptional, hard to explain kind of nice. And then they told my parents about the even harder to explain whistling that happened every morning at 3:03 and ended at the tick of 3:05. The group, our new neighbors, warned my parents that the whistling was quiet and would never harm or hurt us as long as we didn't look for what was making the sound. This part they stressed, and I pushed my ear into the door, straining to hear them. People who went looking for the whistler had their luck change, sometimes tragically. A black cloud would hang over anyone that looked. Anything that could go wrong would. The manila envelope the committee brought over contained newspaper clippings, stories about car crashes and ruined lives, public deaths and freak accidents.
"Not everyone dies," I heard the head of the committee tell my dad. "But the life goes out of him. Even if they live, there's no light in him ever again, no presence."
My mom, I could tell she wasn't taking it seriously. She kept asking if this was some prank they play on new neighbors. At one point, my mom got angry, accused the committee of trying to scare us out of our new home, asked them if they were racist on account of my dad being from the islands. My dad calmed her down, told her he could tell our new neighbors were sincere and they were just trying to help us. He explained that he grew up hearing these kinds of stories from his mom and that he knew there were strange things that walked among us. Some of those strange things were good and some were bad, but most were just different. After the committee left, Dad went out to the hardware store, bought the canvas blinds, the latches, and the locks, and installed them on every window in the house after dinner. That first night in our new house, I crept out of my room at 3 a.m. only to find my dad awake sitting on the living room couch holding my baby sister. My dad held up his finger in a shh motion, but patted the couch next to him. I sat, and we waited. At exactly 3:03, we heard the whistling. It came and it went, just like our neighbors said. The whistling returns each night, and we never look, and we enjoy our million little blessings every day. Nola breathes on her own, and she's grown into a strong, clever girl. My dad even joined the welcoming committee. We don't get new neighbors often. Why would anyone want to leave? But when a family does move in, my dad and the committee bring them macaroni casserole, a gift basket, and the manila folder. I can always tell by the look on my dad's face when he comes back if the family took the committee seriously or if we'd be getting new neighbors again very soon. Not so long ago, a family moved in directly next to us. The previous owner, Ms. Maddie, passed away at the age of 105. She'd lived a good, long life. Our new neighbors seemed like they'd fit in just fine. They believed the welcoming committee, took my dad's advice about the locking shutters since they had a young child of their own. Whatever newspaper clippings were in that manila envelope, whatever evidence, my dad never let us see it. But I imagine it must have been awfully convincing, since our neighbors got along with no issues for the first month. One night, when our new neighbors had to leave town, they sent their son, Holden, to stay with us. He was 12, a year under me in school. I didn't know him well before that night, but as soon as his parents dropped him off at dinner, I could tell it was going to be a bad time. "Do you know who's always out there whistling every night?" Holden asked me the moment the adults left the room. The three of us were sitting in the den, some Disney movie playing idly on the television. My sister and I exchanged a glance. "We don't talk about that," I said.
"I think it's that weirdo that lives in the big yellow house on the corner," Holden said.
"Mr. Tolles?" my sister asked.
"No way. He's really nice."
Holden shrugged.
"It must be a psycho killer then."
Nola tensed.
"We don't talk about it," I repeated.
"Let's go into my room and play Nintendo." We spent the next few hours playing games, eating popcorn, and then watching movies. A typical sleepover. But I could see Holden was getting antsy. After my parents had wished us a good night, locked the blinds, and gone to bed, Holden stood up from his beanbag and walked over to where Nola and I were sitting on my bed.
"Have you ever even tried looking?" he asked. "It's nearly time."
Like most sleepovers, we'd conveniently ignored any suggestion of a bedtime. I was shocked to see he was right. It was almost 3 a.m. I sighed.
"We don't... See, I can't. I can't even try to look because my dad locks the blinds every night and hides the key,"
he continued, ignoring me.
"So does our dad," said Nola.
"No," replied Holden. "No, he doesn't."
"You saw him do it," I said, a little sharper than I meant to sound. Holden grinned.
"Your dad locks the blinds, yeah, but he doesn't hide the key. He keeps it right on his normal keychain.
So? I asked, worried I would already know what he would say next, because I had noticed that my dad didn't bother hiding the key anymore after all these years, because he knew we took it seriously.
So, after your dad locked up, but before your parents went to bed, I went to the bathroom. And on my way, I may have peeked into their room, and I may have seen your dad's keychain on his nightstand, and I maybe went and borrowed the key to the blinds.
Nola and I stared, and Holden's grin only grew wider.
You're lying, I said.
Holden shrugged.
You can check if you want. Just open your parents' door and look. You'll see his keychain right there on the nightstand.
Stay here, I told both of them. Don't move a muscle. I hurried over to my parents' room, but hesitated at the door. If Holden wasn't lying, my dad would be angry. Beyond angry. I was scared thinking about it. But more scared of an open window with a whistler right outside. I opened the door barely an inch and looked in, but it was too dark to see. Taking a deep breath, I walked into the room. Two steps into the dark, I froze. The whistling started, and I could hear it clearly from my parents' room. I never realized, but they must have heard the sound every night since we moved into the house. They never told us. I don't think I could have slept through it. I stood there, listening to the whistler come closer, unsure whether I should turn on a light or call out for my dad. Soft sounds from the living room brought me back to reality.
Nola!
I yelled, running out of my parents' room. Holden and Nola were standing near the front door next to a window. Holden wasn't lying. I could see him fumbling with the lock on one of the blinds. I heard a click. He did have the key. Holden let out a quick laugh. Nola stood next to him, hunched up, afraid, but maybe curious. The whistling was right outside our house now. I think I made a sound, called out. I can't remember. Time felt frozen, clock hands nailed to the face, but I found myself moving. I'm not fast. I've never been athletic. Somehow, though, I covered the space between myself and Nola in a moment. My eyes were locked on her, but I heard Holden pull the blind all the way down so it could release. I heard the snap of it start to raise, and I heard the whistling just on the other side of the window. But I had my arms around Nola, and I turned us so she was facing away from the window. At the same time, I jammed my eyes shut. The blind whipped open. The whistling stopped. I felt Nola shaking in my arms. "Don't look, okay?" I told her. "Don't turn around." We were positioned so that she was facing back towards the hallway and I was facing the window. My eyes were still closed. I felt her nod into my shoulder. I reached out with the arm not holding Nola and tried to touch Holden. My hand brushed against his arm. He was shaking worse than Nola.
"Holden?"
I asked. Silence. I reached past him and gingerly felt for the window, eyes still sealed shut. The glass was cold against my fingertips, colder than it should have been for that time of year. I moved my hand up the window, searching for the string to the blind. The glass began to get warmer the further I reached, and there was a gentle hum feeding back into my fingertips. I tried not to think about what might be on the other side of the window. Finally, I touched the string and yanked the blinds shut. I opened my eyes. In the dim light leaking out from the kitchen, I could make out Holden, pale and small, staring at the now closed window.
"Holden?"
I asked again. He turned towards me, and he screamed. Everything became a flurry of motion. Lights burst to life in the hall, then the living room. My parents' footsteps thudded across the hardwood floor. I didn't turn to look back at them. My eyes were glued to Holden. He was pale, had bit his lip so hard there was a thin red line of blood running down his chin, and he'd wet himself.
"What happened?"
my dad asked from behind me. I managed to swivel away from Holden and look back. He looked. I'd never seen my dad scared before. But I saw it that night, in that moment. An old, ugly terror stitched on his face. A parent's fear.
Just holding?
He mouthed at me. I nodded yes. My dad let out a breath. He looked so relieved I nearly expected him to cheer. But then my dad turned to Holden, and his face changed. I wondered if he felt bad for feeling good that Holden was the only one that looked. There was a knock at the door. We all froze. Holden whimpered.
Don't answer it, my mom said.
She stood at the threshold of the hall. I'd always thought she was a skeptic and just humored my dad about the windows and the whistler. But that night, we were all believers. I noticed that both of my parents held baseball bats they must have taken from their bedroom. The knock came again, a little louder this time.
Please don't open the door, Holden whispered.
My dad walked over to him, hugged him close.
We won't,
my dad promised, still holding his bat.
Nothing is coming in here tonight. Thud, thud, thud.
This time, the knocking was loud enough to rattle the door. Holden screamed again, and Nola clutched her arms around my neck. My mom came over and knelt down next to us, wrapping my sister and me close.
Thud, thud, thud.
Call the police,
my mom whispered to my dad. The knocking instantly stopped. My dad looked over his shoulder at us.
Do you think...
He was cut off by frantic knocking that trailed off to a polite tap, tap, tap.
Police,
something said from the other side of the door. The voice from outside sounded exactly like my mom, like a parrot repeating the words back to her.
Police, call the police.
Tap, tap, tap.
Police.
My mom pulled us closer.
Police, 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 police.
Please stop,
I heard her whisper.
I don't think calling them will help, my dad said. How will we know when they're the ones at the door?
The knocking came back harder than before. The door shook. Then it stopped. After a long moment, I heard the knocking again, but it was coming from our back door. We all turned together towards the back door, but the knocking immediately returned to the front door. Front to back, back to front, loud, then quiet, then loud again. Suddenly, the sound was coming from both doors at once. Big, heavy blows like a sledgehammer. Then, something started rapping against all of the windows in the house. Then the walls. It was like we were living inside a drum with a dozen people trying to play at once. Or we were a turtle and something was attempting to claw us out of our shell.
Stop!
Holden yelled. The knocking died.
I won't tell, Holden said, staring at the door. I promise I won't tell anyone what I saw. Just please go away.
We waited for nearly a minute. Then we heard it, a soft tap, 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 coming from the window Holden had looked through earlier. Holden started to cry, sobbing like a prisoner watching gallows being built outside their cell. My dad held him, brushed his hair, but never lied to him, never told him things would be okay. The tapping at the window went on for the rest of the night. We huddled together in the living room for I don't know how long. Eventually, my mom tried to take us kids into my room while my dad stayed to watch the door. But the second we moved into my bedroom, the knocking came back, so loud it was impossible to ignore. I was afraid the door couldn't take it. We went back to the living room, and the knocking stopped. Only the tap, tap, tap on the window remained. None of us slept that night. The tapping stopped around 7 a.m. That's about the time the sun comes up. We waited another 2 hours before my dad opened the blinds from one window. He made us all go back to my parents' bedroom first. I heard him open the door, then come back in.
Okay, he told us. It's done.
Holden's parents came back around lunchtime. My mom and dad walked Holden over to his house, and they all went inside for quite a while. Nola and I watched from the window. She stuck to me the whole day, right at my side, sometimes holding my hand. When my parents came back, they looked grim but wouldn't tell us what they said to Holden's family. It was a Sunday, so we all spent the day together, ordered pizza, and watched movies. That night, everyone slept in my room. Nola and my mom in the bed with me, my dad in a chair he'd pulled over. There was no knocking that night, or any night since. We didn't see much of Holden or his parents for the rest of that week, but by Thursday, there was a moving truck in their driveway. Nola and I watched them packing up the whole afternoon after school. What sticks with me most is how tired Holden and his parents looked. All three had the same pallor, grim mouths, and lightless eyes. Even from across the street, I could tell something was very wrong. Holden and his family were gone before sunset. I remember what the original welcoming committee said to my parents when we moved in. Not everyone who looks at the Whistler dies, but even those that live have the light go out of them, and the rest of their lives are full of misfortune. A million little tragedies. I think Holden's parents must have looked, either to comfort him if they didn't believe, or share the burden if they did. I watch Nola some days, happy and young and alive, and I wonder if I'd been slower, if she'd looked out the window that night, would I have looked too? To comfort her? To share that burden? I'm glad I don't have to find out. We still live in that house, in that neighborhood. We still hear our Whistler walking past every night. The blessings, the luck, the good things here are too good to leave. But we're careful. We don't have friends over to spend the night anymore. And my dad hides the key to the blinds very, very well. Not that I've gone looking. Some things you just don't need to look for. You've been listening to Something Walks Whistling by Travis Brown. Travis Brown is an author that lives in Maryland. He has several short story collections out with Velix Books and regularly contributes to true crime, horror, and mystery podcasts. Beyond that, he enjoys spending time with his fiance and their deeply spoiled Weimaraner, Parker. Well, listeners, I dare say that I've shaken off some of my post-Halloween blues, at least for the time being. Thanks to E. Reyes and Travis Brown for their help with that. Also, I'd like to mention that both of these authors have collections available through Velix Books, so I recommend you head over to their site, www.velixbooks.com, to take a look. Thank you to all of you for joining me as we begin the harsh slide into winter. Don't worry, though. I'll be here every week to keep you nice and warm and cared for, whether you like it or not. I hope you all had a great Halloween season, and until next week, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights.
As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.